Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. It could be said that the great 19th century American writer Henry David Thoreau gave the powerless one of the most precious gifts one can give, and that is the philosophy of civil disobedience. His essay on civil disobedience would go on to inspire the likes of Mahatma Gandhi as well as Martin Luther King Jr., many more, including inspiring people today. This year does mark the 200th birthday of Henry David Thoreau, and we are going to be in conversation about his life. Joining me now is Laura Dasa-Walls. She is the William P. and Harvard B. White Professor of English at the University of Notre Dame, and she is the author of a new biography that's called Henry David Thoreau, A Life. Laura Dasa-Walls, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And I'm excited to have this conversation. Henry David Thoreau is so connected, I think, in our own imagination to Walden Pond for the time he spent there between, I think, 1845, 1849, and then obviously the book that he wrote about his experience there. And I think in the popular imagination, we think of Walden as this isolated, natural, pristine place untouched by industrialization. But it seems to me, in spending a great amount of time with your book, that it was important for you to show that that is not necessarily the case of Walden. And Henry David Thoreau, even when he was at Walden Pond during these years, was experiencing a changing world, something that we may, in fact, be able to relate to today.
Yes, I think both those points are really crucial. First of all, going to Walden was a little bit like setting up camp in your backyard. I mean, not quite that much, but it's only about a mile from the center of town. And back then, walking a mile was something people did without thinking twice about it. So it's where you went to fish. People went there to hunt. People cut wood on the shores and the trees. And it was a place people walked to for leisure time. So it was really a popular place to be. And I think part of the reason he went there was that the railroad had just gone past and even cut into one of the coves of Walden Pond. And Emerson used to walk to the pond on the other side on the main road. So you've got the pond right in between those two transportation networks. But Emerson was taking that walk on a particular day when some land speculators drawn by that brand new railroad were about to buy that piece of property. And Emerson got his own bid in to preserve it because he wanted to keep having this nice place to walk to. And that was in fall of 1844, and the friends got to talking, and Thoreau had been talking about moving out to a pond someday soon. And one thing led to another, and it became Thoreau's turn to sort of do this experimental house building. But the conditions for that chance for him to do it ironically came about because it was A, on the main road, and B, across the pond was the railroad, the brand new railroad. So there he was, in sight of everybody and staring out at this train that, if you look at train schedules, that train was passing about 20 times a day by the time he left.
20 times a day?
Yeah.
Far from being secluded.
Freight.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a real, his expressions of desire for doing this make it sound like a real deep inward journey. It does sort of give that hermit feeling. He wants that isolation and aloneness. And there's kind of a feeling in his journal and in the early pages of Walden that he's done it. And I think that really carries over in our imaginations. We want that to be the case. We sort of imagine it out in the wilderness. But the more you go into Walden, and again, if you look at the record and you just go to the place and look around, wow, a lot of it was a sense that you can find these wild places, these strange surprises, wherever you are. I'm New York City, Berkeley. I grew up in Seattle, or just on the edge of Seattle, and that was certainly my experience. And so that sense that no matter where you are, you've got some place right there that if you open your eyes, becomes wild to your perception, if you really see truly.
Even in the city?
Even in the city, yeah. So then the other thing that happens is, so he goes there in this kind of like I say, a kind of hermit, even religious aspiration. But it does happen to be the case that he's right there in sight of everybody. And of course, as soon as he starts to build, everybody is coming around saying, hey, what you doing? So if he'd been out in the wilderness, a true sort of John Muir wilderness, it would have been a very different story. But because there were all these people coming by asking, you know, this is an odd thing. You're building this very trim, very tight, formal, but small house right here. So he started to explain himself. He loved to talk. This is another feature that we sort of lose sight of. He was famous as a talker. So he would talk. And he started to fall into this mode of explaining what he was doing and realizing that he was doing some good teaching. He was a kind of born teacher, and he enjoyed this role. It got him into this mode of exploring the possibilities of what he could be doing there, not just in an inner life, the original goal, but also what could he communicate to others? How could he convey to them not just the privacy of his own project, but how they too could sort of catch a piece of this ambition and elevate their own lives?
I want to ask you, somebody who's very familiar with his writings, obviously Walden, but you read his journals and probably read everything that he has written that we know of. Did he ever complain about some damn train going by every half hour?
I've never found...
You never?
Sorry. No, I literally have not found any complaints. He is most explicit. Well, for one thing, he tore apart his original journal writings, many of them, in the writing of his early books, so... He might have had complaints that just he literally used it and threw it away. It was only later, after he returned from Walden, that he started to preserve all of his journal records so that we had a complete, that starts about 1850, but Walden is in the 1840s. So, well, I don't know, maybe there were. I've often wondered, so he, the key turning point in his life was just before Walden, he went to New York City, Staten Island for... 7 months or so, trying to break into the New York literary market. That was a failure. He was not a New York writer, and he ended up returning, as we all know, and eventually at Walden Pond. But the key point is that it was while he was gone that the railroad went in. Hmm. So here you've got somebody who loved the pond, went away to this big city, and is dreaming, literally dreaming of the pond and longing to be back there. He was so homesick. And he comes back, and there's the railroad. It has just ripped this trench. There's, you know, scores and scores of railroad workers are building this thing, and it's right there, literally heaps of dirt in the waters of the pond itself. I would love to know what he thought.
But
if there was a time for him to have complained, it would have been then. Yeah. But we don't have the journal for then.
Right.
And he's not writing letters because he's always writing letters home. Well, he was home, so he didn't need to write letters. So darn it all. But somehow we get the ambivalence in Walden, the sense of excitement. I mean, it was a thrill. Can you imagine seeing that speeding railroad engine for the first time?
That's right.
And sudden sense of freedom. You could go to Boston, you know, in an hour instead of a day.
That's right. The future is here.
The future is here. This, and it really radiates through this whole literature of all these people who are just, you know, it opens possibility. And he was totally excited, as was everybody else, about what this would do. At the same time, he's kind of a little skeptical and thinking, well, are we so sure that this is a good thing? So he's asking questions. And the several pages in Walden where he looks out at that railroad are really pretty interesting because it's a mix of emotions and very interesting intellectual reactions. What do we do about this? How do we think about it? What are the moral consequences of this? So it's complex, and I think really it's one of the important sections of Walden.
And questions we're grappling with today.
Yeah, it's a confrontation with modernity, we can say, and we're still confronting it. It's like he was on the front end of a process, and we may be on the back end.
This is the beginning.
It's the same process.
This period of time is the beginning of what we call the Anthropocene.
It was. I mean, I don't think the geologists would necessarily agree. They're looking for that, what they call the golden spike, when they can say, yes, you know, a million years from now, some future geologist could say, at this moment. So atomic radiation looks like a good candidate. And we don't have that until, unfortunately, our own time. Well, Thoreau, of course, lives before then, so maybe it won't be the golden spike for the geologists. But for us, perceptually, when you start to see that great acceleration, that shift, the railroad is a good, good marker. And Thoreau was right there watching it come to the United States and to his part of the world. And so for him, he is watching the shift from a colonial era, very sustainable, agricultural, horticultural, kind of a mixed-use, surprisingly balanced economy. It was limited. It had its limits. But it was, for 200 years, it had been a successful, stable use of the land along a kind of English agricultural system. He watched all that collapse and retool into a much more modern market economy. And he watched farmers lose their land. He watched the land depopulate. He watched farmers have to shift their crops, and suddenly they're worrying about getting things to market.
A decrease in wildlife.
The decrease in wildlife. Well, a lot of that had already happened. It's startling to realize, for instance, that he never saw a deer around Walden Pond or anywhere in the area. A deer, can you imagine? I mean, they're everywhere now. He never saw anything bigger, as far as I can tell from all his writings, bigger than a woodchuck. So he had to go to Maine to see a moose because they still had wildlife there. So the beaver were gone, the turkeys were gone, the deer were gone, things that are all back today, ironically. He was in many ways in a much more depopulated and certainly almost completely deforested landscape. It had all been clear-cut by the 1850s. We come back now, and if you go to Walden, I hope you and some of your listeners have or will, you look around, there's trees everywhere. And they've all grown back since Thoreau's day. All he saw were, by the 1850s, were little copses of trees here and there, which meant that he could look back on even his own childhood just a couple decades before and say, I knew this pond when it was completely forested, and I used to love those forests. He called the pond with the woods in the backdrop the drapery of my dreams. Beautiful image, and it haunted him. So he's there, but he's there and watching it disappear. I don't know how many people today identify with this, but I know growing up, I identified profoundly with this because I saw exactly the same thing happening right outside Seattle, where I grew up.
Interesting. I don't live in a very natural area. I live in a downtown Oakland of all places, yet it's going through these dramatic changes. Buildings are being smashed, brought down, new ones are being erected. Mm-hmm. And it, for me, it is always, and this is all fascinating because it does, people have a great deal amount of gentrification going on. And for me, watching this, being there, experiencing this, definitely brings a sense of melancholy to it. But I also try to see the railroad as the the sign of the future.
Yeah. And if you think about, again, what the railroad means, we think of it as old-fashioned technology. And really, many of us would like to see the railroads brought back and strengthened and made more a part of our United States transportation system. As opposed to cars, they look great. For Thoreau, of course, again, at the leading edge of all this, the railroad is the beginning of what he starts calling later in his life the coming of the evil days, when he imagined tracks circling the earth and in a sense kind of strangling it in the kind of meshes of the economy that the railroad not only represents but is and carries. So his thoughts on this become darker as he watches what everybody was calling progress. And again, he starts to think, are we so sure that what we are calling progress is progress for everyone? And are we so sure that it's progress even for ourselves?
We are in conversation with Laura Dassel-Walls. She is the author of the book, Henry David Thoreau, A Life. She also is a professor of English at Notre Dame University. Can you tell me, you mentioned his name earlier, and that of Emerson. We're talking about Ralph Waldo Emerson here. Can you tell me about his relationship to Emerson?
Yeah, that's a big part of the story. We'll start here. Thoreau was born in Concord. Emerson was not. Emerson saw Concord as part of his family legacy, since his grandfather had been there. And so he felt in a way that when he moved to Concord, he was returning to a kind of ancestral home. Thoreau, in the meantime, born in Concord, his family had returned when he was a child, becomes ambitious as a writer, goes to Harvard, starts to pursue his dream, and returns after college to his hometown. And in the meantime, this celebrity author has moved into his hometown. And it's a tense relationship. Thoreau is the young man who wants to make a name for himself, and he looks over to this very dominant personality who's pretty much claiming all the ground for himself and saying, how do I get a piece of this? How do I? I mean, he's excited. Emerson is breaking new ground and extremely innovative ways of thinking and doing new things with words, language that, in a way, it's the necessary path that Thoreau had to take. Was what he ended up doing was finding a way into Emerson's home life, and they became deep, each other's best and closest friends. But there was always that sense of rivalry. So there's a period of apprenticeship when Thoreau is literally living in Emerson's house and learning how to be a writer and how to be a thinker, how to be a philosopher. And then there's a period when Thoreau has to find a way of expressing what is in his own mind and heart that is somewhat different than what Emerson thinks is appropriate. So I mentioned him going to Staten Island. Thoreau pursuing that independent vocation as a writer meant breaking away, or trying to break away, from Emerson. And that's really when you start feeling that tension. By the time, years and years later, he's finished Walden, Emerson loves Walden. Thoreau realizes that he's finally written the book that proves that he is his own person. Emerson could never have written Walden. And at that point, they start to relax with each other again, because Thoreau has finally accomplished something great. Emerson can say, yes, you really have. I had great hopes for you. And then for a while, I thought those hopes were dashed. I thought you wouldn't come up to them. And now you have.
How many years difference is there between them?
Oh, gosh, 14.
Okay.
Emerson was 14 years older. So then they start to relax a little bit with each other, and the friendship resumes at more of a sense of equality. But that rivalry is never too far from there. Especially, I think Emerson was less aware of it. Thoreau was very aware of it. Loved him dearly, but also felt this kind of contestatory. So Emerson says, you know, every time I meet Thoreau, it's like he's ready to pick a fight. Well, Thoreau was not like that with everybody, but he was like that with Emerson.
With Emerson.
Yeah. So, and I think it's true, as many have observed, that we can read Thoreau's journals, we can see some of his unpublished work and realize the biggest projects that he was on, how deep and broad and really innovative and exciting they were. Emerson didn't see those, because Thoreau kept those journals private, even from Emerson. It was after Thoreau's death, when Emerson read them, that he realized that he never really understood his friend, because he hadn't seen the journals and was in awe of what his friend had been able to achieve as a writer.
I do want to ask you, because both of these people, Thoreau and Emerson, are seen as leading or important figures anyways in this philosophical movement known as transcendentalism. What is that?
Oh, God. I was afraid you were going to ask it. More
in 30 words or less, yes.
Yeah, the less certain. Well, I will say, and it begins as a kind of religious movement and then starts to spread out into education and philosophy and science studies and all sorts of other directions, literature, of course. But the key idea, and I'm really thinking I need to really come back and like work seriously on figuring out how to understand this key idea, goes back to a theologian that Emerson and many of his generation knew and loved, William Ellery Channing. Today, people don't know his name at all. But Channing had this key insight when he said, human beings, in his terms, have a likeness to God. And so again, he's a theologian, so this is how he's going to put it. But what he meant was that we have a kind of deep spiritual dimension that within us, each and every human being, that allows us to see, again, what he calls God in the world, in all of the surrounding world, and in each other. And the more you are aware of that dimension within yourself, the more you see it in the world. And so this is an interesting, you know, he would call it God. Thoreau broke away from conventional religion and struggles with, so what do you call it if you're not going to call it God? But if you imagine transcendentalism as, first of all, looking at all human beings, no matter what race, which gender, where you came from, all religions having some element of this deep inner truth. And then saying, well, we must respect all human beings. And this is the beginning of the abolitionist movement.
That's right.
When he worked Channing with looks around
Underground Railroad.
Yes, Thoreau did. And so this becomes a conviction that you must end slavery. It is an absolute moral and political imperative to end slavery, because legally, slaves were not human beings, but a transcendentalist looked at enslaved people and said, they are just as human as I do. This has to stop. And so this becomes the all-commanding imperative of this generation to awake the people up to end slavery. It becomes the founding of the women's rights movement in America, because of course women are saying, we understand what enslaved people go through because our position is not that different. We too are in essence owned by a man, our husbands, our fathers, and do not have legal independence. So again, transcendentalism becomes the kind of conviction that allows somebody like Margaret Fuller to become the founding feminist. The philosophy of the women's rights movement in America traces back to Emerson's and Thoreau's friend Margaret Fuller.
Hmm.
Who declares for the equality of the sexes, right? Really radical stuff back then. Native Americans, same thing. The incoming Irish immigrants and other immigrants from around the world, it's the same thing. And so this is where you get that conviction that you have to extend equality to all human beings. Thoreau's innovation is to say, not only is this inner, again, what Channing would have called likeness to God, not only is it within all human beings, it's within all beings, non-human also. So Thoreau extends this ethical, moral circle from the human community out into the natural community, and says it's all tied together. It's all part of a great integral whole, and we have to respect all of it. We can't use any of it as a tool for our use and our pleasure.
How did he put that into practice with the natural world? And I mean, was he a vegetarian? I mean, that's one way we think about it today. Of course, you could still be respectful and not be a vegetarian. But how do you do that?
Yeah, that's an interesting example, because here's where a couple things conflict. So, of course, I use this as an example of living deliberately. He says, I went to the pond because I wished to live deliberately. So here's a great example, vegetarianism. Living deliberately means deliberating the choices you must make. And I like to point out that we don't deliberate. It's like a judge. You don't go to court with the easy cases. You go to court with the tough ones, the ones that have no obvious answer. You have to really work it through and think about it. So Thoreau is thinking about whether he can eat meat. And here's the deliberation. On the one hand, he thinks, absolutely not. I mean, you can't kill an animal and eat it and not feel your kinship. This is a form of murder. On the other hand, he loves fish. I mean, beef and red meat, he can do without, but there's something about fish that both the act of fishing, which he sees as a kind of, you know, harmony with nature, nature's bounty, and plus he just loves fish, craves them. So he starts to accuse himself, how can he fish and still honor himself as a moral human being? How can he kill fish specimens for science? He's collecting for Louis Agassiz, who wants to have examples of all the fishes of the United States. Well,
he's a Harvard scientist,
yeah,
Louis Agassiz.
The Harvard scientist, zoologist.
Yeah, and known for not seeing and arguing that not all the races were the same.
Yeah, well, that creates, you know, tremendous tension, and Thoreau argues with Agassiz in person about lots of things. So that's a sort of another direction. Before we go there, we'll just come back to this, because there's a third dimension too. So he's wrestling with himself on vegetarianism, but then he's also he's not a householder. He doesn't command a household himself. He is a member of a very large household run by his mother and his father. They have a boarding house, a number of boarders, and of course he has three a brother and two sisters, aunts, one uncle, etc. So he's often a guest at the tables of other people. So they are serving meat. What does he do? And the interesting thing here is it becomes situational, because his friends report that if they served meat at the table, he would eat what was available. He would eat what they served and be courteous about it. He would not lecture them. At the same time, he would go off in his private journal, and we see some of this in Walden, and he would worry about whether this was appropriate behavior and how would you convince people. So there's deliberation for you. You know, it's not an absolutist sort of pure position in that he says, I will never eat meat. But it really bothers him that we as human beings are in this situation where we crave something that morally we should not have. So it's a kind of index. You see how tough this is? The answer is for Thoreau. He often can project a sense of absolute certainty that kind of masks his own inner struggles to figure out what the right path is.
Again, we are in conversation with Laura Dassel-Walls. She is the author of the book, Henry David Thoreau, A Life. She is also a professor of English at Notre Dame University. In my introduction, I talked about his essay on civil disobedience. So I'm going to push us there, because I want to make sure. I would hate not to talk about it at all after I introduced conversation that way. And I said in my introduction that this essay would influence the likes of Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., still influencing many people today and all over. Who influenced Henry David Thoreau to come up with this idea of civil disobedience?
Well, the answer might surprise folks. It was Bronson Alcott. This is Louisa May Alcott's father. Bronson Alcott was involved with William Lloyd Garrison in the non-resistance movement, and this was an outgrowth of abolitionism. And so their platform was you could not offer resistance, physical resistance, to any form of force. So look, they regarded government and all aspects of sort of formal government as forms of force. So of course you couldn't join the military, but they would go as far as saying, not only could you not be a soldier and carry a gun, that was obviously force, but even voting was a form of coercion. So it was a very interesting and kind of, even in its own day, extreme form of withdrawal from. And the notion was we could all learn to cooperate without the use of force through love, that love would radiate outward and sort of involve people in collaborating and cooperating, and sort of structures that would sort of catch on and spread. So Bronson Alcott brought this non-resistance philosophy to Concord when he moved there in 1840. And Thoreau was really persuaded, as he wasn't the only one, but so it becomes a very lively discussion in Concord, because Alcott was a great talker. He would cultivate his ideas by holding formal conversations. So Alcott, of course, is not paying his taxes, and he creates a kind of possibility for others to join the movement by refusing to pay their taxes. And he doesn't have many recruits, but Thoreau is the one that we know about. And Thoreau decides he's right. Paying taxes means you're sort of bowing to a form of coercion. So I will not pay my taxes. I will contribute to society through non-coercive means.
And he would spend a night in jail for that. Yeah.
So refusing to pay his taxes means he's on the wrong side of the law. And when the jailer and tax collector, who are the same person, stop him on the street when he comes
Sam Staples.
From Walden Pond. Sam Staples, they are friends before and after.
Sam Staples offers to pay his taxes for him.
Does, and you know, this had happened with Alcott, the same thing. Somebody else paid the taxes, and so the family, you know, breathed a sigh of relief, and Bronson Alcott was not jailed. Thoreau said, no, Sam, I am not going to pay that tax. You'll have to jail me. When Sam offered to pay it, Thoreau says, don't you do that. Well, of course, once he's in jail, one of the family, probably his aunt, does pay the taxes. And so he gets to go free the next morning. But because Alcott had done this before, and also one other of Alcott's friends had also done this before in Concord and been threatened with jail, they knew how this would play out. And by the Thoreau is the third one who's arrested under this, you know, this cohort of friends who take this same stand. Thoreau knew how this would play out, and when it happened to him, he was ready. So he took his stand. I think the impact of it really shocked him, in that the town did not think that this was cute or funny or revolutionary. They thought it was kind of a vandalism, a kind of assault on normal good behavior. And people were pretty universally really, really critical. And Thoreau, I think, was taken aback by that and spent some time questioning, had he done the right thing? You know, had he misjudged the situation? But that thinking becomes the lecture, which becomes the great essay, Civil Disobedience, where in thinking carefully, okay, now it's happened to me. What did I just do? And why did I do it? And was it the right thing to do? He realizes, yes, it had to be the right thing, because the principle of it is you must never allow yourself to become the agent of injustice to another. And paying taxes became the point where, because this is the tax that allows you to vote, everybody had the choice to either pay them or not pay them. So this is the moment when, in his view, the state intervenes in your life and says, you have that choice. Either go along with this force and pay or refuse. And Thoreau says, if I refuse and take a moral stand, others will witness my stand. And if I make it clear why, that this is a protest against slavery, and injustice towards Native Americans and towards, this is during the Mexican War, so the third case is against the
Mexican-American War. Yeah.
Yeah. Then people will understand that it's a moral. It's not that I'm poor and I can't pay. It's a moral stance. And I will persuade people to realize that they must consider this choice in their own lives. And if they wish to be moral, ethical people, they must make the same choice I did. And it will spread. So this is the core of civil disobedience, which is an elaboration of these ideas. And it's in some ways a very, very simple idea, but of course applied, it gets really complicated really quickly.
Well, I want to ask you about a contradiction, that it seems like a contradiction, and maybe not. I'll let you take that issue on. But after he comes out with these ideas of civil disobedience, he would be one of the very few people, including from the abolitionist community, that would give a very strong defense for John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. How can we reconcile that he comes up with civil disobedience, and yet when many abolitionists criticized John Brown harshly, he defended him?
Absolutely, and this is exactly when I said it gets really complicated, because you can see the principle of refusing to be the agent of injustice to another is a form of nonviolence. And remember, going back to the core, this non-resistance society, the whole core of it was nonviolence. By the time Thoreau is writing Civil Disobedience, the situation with slavery has deteriorated so much that he starts to worry. He's not there yet, but he starts to worry that there could be circumstances when it would be morally imperative to commit violence to protect another, to protect the slaves, to essentially shield them from the violence of the state. And he knew escaped slaves, former enslaved people, were in a circle of friends. Frederick Douglass is the most well-known. So he knew their stories, and he knew this was not abstract to him. He saw the scars on their backs. He helped fugitive slaves flee to Canada. So he's thinking, do we not have the moral obligation to stand up in their defense, even if it means accepting violence against our own persons, or maybe committing violence? Well, fast forward to John Brown, and then the situation has deteriorated such that the United States is immersed in violence, North and South, and the sense that, I mean, we know when the Civil War started, right? So April 1861, that's when the shooting war started. But if you follow the history of the 1850s, the Thoreau's time, you see how this deterioration of the situation, the violence was endemic. And part of what Thoreau's looking at is, how do we collaborate in this kind of systemic violence? We wouldn't beat a slave, right? But we buy the sugar that is produced by the slave labor. Emerson has a great line. We purchase the sugar. No one tastes the blood in it. No one tastes the blood. So Thoreau is extending that, saying, look, even the very sugar that we sweeten our coffee with is got the blood of slaves in it. We cannot escape. Everywhere we turn, this violence is part of our lives. How do we stop it? Because it's gone too far for nonviolence to be effective. This is where he is in 1859. So when John Brown pushes the point by trying to foment an insurrection, a violent insurrection, Thoreau is one of the first people to say, John Brown understands something that none of us have yet quite grasped, that that standing up in defense of the 4 millions of slaves is now the only choice left to us, because this must stop. And so he gets out there in front of the world and defends John Brown, and everybody else is saying John Brown is a criminal and a madman. And Thoreau says he's the only one acting on the right side of justice, and he is the only sane person. And it's out there. The surprise is how quickly other people are persuaded. He's not, As far as I can tell, he's the first one to stand up and speak, but there are other people who are standing up and speaking. Thomas Wentworth Higginson is one of them. And right about the same, you know, within hours of each other, and the word starts to spread. Thoreau gives the lecture in defense of John Brown to a couple of very large audiences, including one in Boston. And pretty soon, the conversation starts to shift. So there we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I, you know, don't ask me about lessons for today because I'm wrestling hard with this.
Well, you mentioned about the political chaos or just of the 1850s. That definitely reminds me of today. But that'll have to be a different discussion on another day because.
Yeah.
In our remaining minutes here together, I do want to talk about the death of Henry David Thoreau. He would die at the age of 44, which is interesting to me because I'm now 45 and growing up admiring Henry David Thoreau. It's interesting. You always see him as being an older man. Now I'm a year older than he was at his death. He died of tuberculosis. And when I was reading about his death in your book, I thought to myself, as you mentioned, here's Henry David Thoreau, somebody who wants to live deliberately and perhaps teach us to live deliberately. I almost felt like he tried to teach us how to die as well. And, he has this line, autumn leaves teach us how to die.
Yeah. That's a really, really, that line goes back to his reaction to his brother's death. He was very, very close to his older brother, and a real key moment in his own life was when his brother died in his arms. And this is before he goes to Walden, really a turning point. And his response right after that, once he's trying, he goes into a profound period of grief, cannot accept this death of the person he loved above all others. But he looks to the autumn leaves and starts thinking about the leaves teaching us how to die. But it's a long lesson. It's a lesson he spends a lot of years working on teaching himself, reconciling himself to the fact that, you know, knowing his brother died means knowing that he too will die. And he looks at autumn through that lens and writes the essay Autumnal Tints, which is an absolutely beautiful one that I would recommend if you want to read more Thoreau. I would say if you want to think about these questions, think about, you know, read Autumnal Tints, and that notion of the autumn leaves. They go at peace. They go beautifully. He's in New England, so, you know, these blazes of color, and each tree and each kind of tree turns, you know, different colors. So there's a kind of wonderful, the light changes, the brilliance of it, and that sense that you can be a kind of giving back of beauty to the world as you undergo this process of leaving the world. I think he really took that to heart. And I'm not sure I'm there because I'm not reconciled to his dying so young. And so I want to get angry.
That's right. This is not
mourn.
That's right. This is not a man who's reconciling his death, who's in his 70s or 80s.
Right. He's young. He knows. It's like, okay, I've read the unpublished, I've looked at the unpublished notes and everything. I know what projects he was working on. He had more great books that he was working on. I've seen how brilliant the very late writing is. And with that much more that he could have contributed to us, to know that he was at peace with bundling it all up and setting it aside unfinished, and saying, I'm ready to let go. It's like, I'm not ready for you to let go. And his friends had the same kind of astonishment. And so that gathering of friends at the deathbed, which tuberculosis is, you know, it takes a long time to take you out. So they had a long time to months of gathering at his bedside and watching him decline further and further. And for them to watch him go out in this way, peacefully, with good humor and grace, was an astonishment to them, and it could only have assured him as he watched them that he was choosing the right path, that he was educating his friends even in the moment of watching his own life ebb away from him.
A couple last things that he said were, "Now comes good sailing," another great little line there. And then his final two words, you'll correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think were moose and Indian.
Yeah, there's some controversy. It appears that they may not have been his absolute last words. In one case, he was thinking about the Maine woods.
That's right. You mentioned earlier that's where he finally saw the moose when he went to Maine.
Where he finally saw the moose, yeah, and where he finally really connected. He became almost a kind of apprenticeship relationship with Joe Polis, an elder of the Penobscot people, and deeply admired Polis. Polis became one of his three heroes, the other two being Walt Whitman and John Brown. Hmm. That's quite a pantheon. And so to be thinking and reflecting on that at the very within hours of his death, so all we know is the record that he spoke the words moose and Indians. And then his sister was reading the pages of his first book, the one on A Week on the Concord and Merrimack, where he's with his brother John, and you know, the wind is up, they're in a little rowboat with a sail, and the wind is up, and they're about to have a splendid day of sailing, and she's reading this passage to him, and she remembered him saying, "Now comes good sailing," as he anticipated this voyage with John. And again, I'm tearing up a little now, because knowing what John meant to him, and to be, in a sense, John had gone before, and he was joining John on this good sailing.
And finally, I think it's important to point this out. He never married.
Right. He certainly was part of a large and active household, as I mentioned before, so it would not be correct to think of him as some kind of isolated loner. He had his room up in the attic where he could retreat when the bustle downstairs got too much for him, and that's, of course, where he did his writing and kept all his peculiar odds and ends of pine cones and birds' nests and things that he brought in from the woods. So that was his domain, but of course he spent much of his time with the rest of the family and with a large and active and vital circle of friends. So marriage was something that, none of his siblings married, and historians have looked at town records and figured out that, you know, a surprising number of young people in Concord in this era did not marry. So this was not unusual. I mean, it may seem remarkable to us, a kind of ethic that, of course, one does this. To Thoreau, it wouldn't have seemed unusual, nor would it have to his family or friends. But that, of course, still leaves aside the question of, why not, or would his life have been different had he married? And it's a tough one because, on the one hand, marriage would have been a different relationship than now. We have a much more egalitarian sense of marriage now. For Thoreau, it would have meant taking responsibility for the life and really a kind of almost ownership of the life of another. Can you imagine the man who owned nothing on principle taking ownership of the life of another? It's impossible. He would never, that was not a relationship that he could imagine for himself. The other is that it's not clear whether or not, and to the extent of which he had attractions to men, more or less than to women. And he himself makes it clear that his own attractions are pretty fluid across genders, and his own sense of his own gender is pretty fluid. Hmm. And stabilizing that through, you know, marriage of a man with a woman, I think did not feel like an appropriate relationship to him, and I don't think he fully was able to articulate why not, but he was satisfied to turn it into a question of what he called chastity, basically saying, I feel this creative energy within, and if I stay chaste, that creative energy, and this is almost verbatim what he says about it, that creative energy will come out in my artistry, in my artwork, in my writing. So we would say, hey, sublimation. That's how he understood his path of chastity. I've often asked my students, and this is appropriate at Notre Dame, of course, to whether or not this is the path of the monk who says, I, in a sense, will devote myself to walking this path of purity and devotion to higher ideals, to a kind of higher vocation. And it is a deliberate choice which one must uphold every moment of every day of one's life toward the path of devotion. And if you put it in those terms, people at a Catholic university will say, yeah, that's a true path. Thoreau didn't have that as a coming from a Protestant tradition as a kind of choice. So he kind of invented it in a Protestant way, which I rather like. That sounds very Thoreauvian.
Laura Dussel-Walls has been our guest. She is a professor of English at Notre Dame University, and she is the author of the book that we have been in conversation about. It's called Henry David Thoreau, A Life. Laura Dussel-Walls, this conversation was everything that I hoped it would be. I thank you greatly.
Well, thank you so much, Mitch. I enjoyed it greatly.